Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowain. Bob Delaney has written two books about his life so far, but his life story could fill several more books. As a young police officer, he worked undercover and infiltrated two notorious organized crime families. After leaving the police force in the late 80s, he became a professional NBA referee. Now he's pursuing a mission that traces back to a darker period in his life. He's helping people who, like him, have suffered or are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. His new book is Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. Bob Delaney, thank you so much for being on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Mike.
So let's start where your story of post-traumatic stress begins. Let's start with your work as an undercover agent. How did you become Bobby Covert?
Yeah, in 1973, I followed in my father's footsteps and joined the New Jersey State Police. And that is an organization steeped in deep military tradition. It was founded by Colonel Schwarzkopf, the father of the famed General Schwarzkopf from the Persian Gulf Wars. And I share that with you because as a general road duty trooper, it wasn't common for a division headquarters lieutenant to call. I got a call one day when I was stationed in Somerville, and it was a note that was put on my box in the office. And, I grew up Irish Catholic. That means I wake up guilty in the morning. I thought I did something wrong. I thought I was in trouble. And I called down to the lieutenant and asked what it was about. He said, I'm going to come up and speak to you if you're going to be in the station for a little bit. He did. He asked if I was interested in doing undercover work. I said, yes, sir. I thought it was narcotics by bust. And I later found out that it was the President's Organized Crime Task Force, the FBI and New Jersey State Police were going to join forces and start a trucking company on the waterfront in New Jersey. I became Bobby Covert. Catchy name for an undercover guy. We weren't trying to be cute or funny. I took on the identity of a child who died at birth. Our birth records and death records are not cross-indexed. So by going to the death records, finding somebody who died at birth, I could go over to the birth record side, get that information, and then start my new persona. So that's how I became Bobby Covert.
And you were young. You were 22?
I was 22 years old at the time that I went undercover.
And then, so now you're running this trucking company under a new name. Who knew that you were doing this? Who was in?
Well, I was made to look as though I was thrown out of the state police. So that was a difficult time for my family as well. And the reason was to push me away from the state police. When we started the undercover investigation, it was three FBI agents and two New Jersey state troopers, myself and another trooper. When the early stages of it, the grant was written for 6 months. They told us we were only going undercover for 6 months. I guess we had an aggressive mindset. We were going to end organized crime in New Jersey in 6 months. Very quickly, we knew that wasn't going to happen. So when we got lucky in the investigation, a guy by the name of Pat Kelly, who was a consigliere for the DiNorgio crew of the Bruno crime family, was going to jail. He decided to become an informant. With him and his contacts, we started a new trucking company in the shadows of the Statue of Liberty in Liberty State Park in Jersey City called Alamo Trucking. I became the president of that. Pat became the informant, became the vice president, and the other trooper and played my bodyguard, and the FBI agents played roles of accountants and truck managers. That's when I became really engrossed in working with the Genovese and Bruno crime family as my partners in that trucking company.
But nobody knew. Did your family know?
No, I let my, my mom and dad knew I was doing undercover work, and I told my grandparents because I was concerned that if, they found out, and one of my grandparents did pass away during the time that I was undercover, I didn't want to think I went bad. They didn't know exactly what I was doing. They just knew I was still there, and they had to keep it quiet.
And as you were getting into this world, did you have any idea how dangerous this job was and how dangerous it would be to your soul, so to say?
No. Early on, great question. The enthusiasm of youth and going after bad guys and thinking it was only for 6 months. And then when 6 months went into a year and a year went into two, and then a two went to the third year, my whole persona changed. I became Bobby Covert. I wasn't playing Bobby Covert. Bob Delaney was in a rearview mirror. I was no longer a part of that. So my morality changed. My values changed. There was a whole transformation that took place within me, and there was a fear level that was tremendous. I was good at doing undercover work. We're all good at doing something. But I'd get 2 miles down the street after meeting with the mob guys, and I'd have to pull over and throw up, or I'd have to get to the first gas station I could find because I had diarrhea. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd be soaking wet. I wouldn't tell anybody that, because that would be admitting to fear, admitting that maybe I couldn't handle this or have that image, because cops, firefighters, soldiers like to think of themselves as leaping tall buildings in a single bound. But I was going through an emotional roller coaster ride during that time that I was undercover.
We're talking with Bob Delaney. He has a new book, Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. And right now we're discussing his years as an undercover agent with the New Jersey State Police he was working with at the time, and then joined an undercover investigation. Give us some idea of a typical scenario. You say you would leave your mob friends, quote unquote, and then throw up. What would happen before you get in your car that caused you to throw up?
Well, I'd be wearing a wire, and it's a reel-to-reel. It's not the type that traditionally would be seen, where somebody's sitting outside. When you're in a deep cover situation, you don't have backup around. You don't have surveillance around. You just go about and live that life. So this reel-to-reel recorder was placed on my body, hidden. Wires were up underneath my armpits. And while I'm having these conversations, I know I'm wearing that wire. Obviously, they don't. But if I get caught with that wire, I know in that world, informants die. So that's the constant fear that I lived in. Meetings could be talking about trucking business, kicking back money, stealing trucks, stealing cars, loan sharking. It could have been about any subject matter. Knowing that pressure that I was under, when I would get in that car and get away and get in a relaxed state, that's when my body would react, and the normal reactions to fear would come out. But I was very good at masking those and controlling those while I was in those situations.
And the members of the organized crime families also shared incredibly violent stories with you at times, just talking about, oh...
Yeah, the bragging of their stories, and they would tell stories of what they've done to people, and but you also were aware of what their past was, because I was privy to the intelligence information on every one of these individuals that I was interacting with, so I knew what their capabilities were. You know, what I thought was going to be the greatest day of my life ended up being the worst. The day we ended the investigation and we held a raid, and early morning hours, FBI agents, state police uniforms, state police detectives go out and pick up the defendants. We're at the West Orange Armory in West Orange, New Jersey. As they start bringing in the defendants, a sergeant by the name of Barry Lardier was assigned to be with me as a security. I had not seen troopers, friends of mine that were there for 3 years. I gained probably about 40 pounds when I was undercover. I didn't have anything on that said I was a state trooper. Barry says to me, you want to go downstairs and see where they're being processed? As I started going downstairs, I said yes when I really didn't want to. I put myself in a military pose. That training came back. I went into parade rest with my arms behind my back, put my chest out. This is the first time these folks are going to see me as Bob Delaney. Guy by the name of Ronnie Sardella was being fingerprinted. As he was being fingerprinted and recuffed, he looked over at me. This is a guy that I had stolen trucks with, that I had been around. He looked over and he said, Bobby, what they pinch you for? And before I could answer, Barry Lardier said to him, pinch? He's not pinched. He's with us. He's a state trooper. Ronnie looked at me, and the look that went between us was not one of anger. It was one of disappointment and hurt. He said to me, Bobby, how can you do this to me? How can you do it to us? We're your friends. I could probably tell you what everybody had on their feet the rest of the day, because it felt terrible. We're socialized not to tell on our friends. It's an unwritten rule in a schoolyard that you don't tell on your friends. And yet what we ask people, so that value of trust was broken. And I felt if someone did that to me, I know how I would feel about them. And then there was a tremendous amount of paranoia. That all the telltale signs of post-traumatic stress is what I started to experience.
But you already experienced some of those signs as you were still undercover. Did you know what it was? Did you put a name on it when you were trembling, when you were getting sick, when you were losing sleep?
No, I didn't know what it was. I just knew that I wanted to hide it, because it would then appear as if I couldn't do this job, and I didn't want the other troopers or FBI agents to think that. So I got lucky. When I surfaced from doing the undercover work, a guy by the name of John Schroth was a detective in the state police assigned to be with me. He was doing some of the investigations. He was the first one. He had a background in psychology from Rutgers University. He was the first one that said to me, you're going through something. I don't know what it is, but every time we go out or stop for a drink after a surveillance or coming back from court, you go back into this Bobby Covert routine. And so that was part of the first sign. And you know, there's more to that as we go along.
I want to just hone in a bit on the stress of not slipping up, because if you've ever tried to keep a story straight, you know how easy it is to slip up. Now, you were out drinking with these guys. You were always around them. Talk about the incredible stress of making sure you didn't slip up in your story or do something wrong.
Yeah, that is a tremendous stress. And there's studies done on lying. If anyone has lied in their life, they know how stressful that is to continue that lie. And there's a reason that people want to purge and tell the truth. And it's the same thing when they commit crimes. They want to help. They want to release that information from inside them because it's holding them down. It hurts inside. And I was living that. I was living the fear of being found out to be wearing a wire, which they would have thought of me as an informant, not as a cop. And I'm constantly lying and telling stories. So keeping that straight in your head and then trying to project on the outside a very calm, confident image while inside you're just on an emotional roller coaster ride.
So you just said after you were released from this duty as being undercover, there were a lot of arrests, but there was really no relief for you.
No, there wasn't. In fact, it intensified. As I said, John Schroth was the first one that said to me, you're going through something. I got lucky because I was brought around the country to talk about this investigation because it was so unique back then. And I happened to be speaking at Jersey City Police Department, and Dr. Hank Campbell, who was my college psychology professor, happened to be there at the same time. We started doing informal therapy. And he was the first one that said to me, Bobby, you're going through post-traumatic stress disorder. I went into total denial. I said, you know, I hear about studies about that from guys coming back from Vietnam. That's not me. And got lucky again. Louis Free, who became the 15th director of the FBI, was a street agent involved in my investigation. He knew I was going through tough times. He introduced me to Joe Pistone. Joe Pistone is the real Donnie Brasco. And that's where I got my introduction to peer-to-peer therapy. Because when I spoke to Joe, I could see it in his body language, I could see it in his eyes, and I could hear it in his voice, that he understood what I was going through because he went through a similar circumstance. And it's important for folks that go through similar traumatic events to speak to someone who, and I choose that word carefully, similar. We don't go through the same. But if we go through it, it validates what we're feeling. And that's important to understand that what you're experiencing is a normal human reaction.
What were some of the symptoms? You already hit on some of them, and we have to take a break in a moment. But what were some of the symptoms? Paranoia, you mentioned.
Paranoia, tremendous amounts of paranoia. I had hypervigilance. I'd walk around in the middle of the night with my gun drawn, pulling back shower curtains, looking behind doors, thinking they were coming to get me. Isolation and avoidance. I didn't want to be around anyone. I had tremendous thirst for revenge, and I also had a tremendous quick anger fits that would show themselves in so many ways.
And did your job feel mundane as you return to being
tremendously,
just a cop?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, I didn't mean to say just a cop, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very hard to recreate that adrenaline feeling or the excitement that I was feeling from the undercover in a day-to-day routine.
We're talking with Bob Delaney. He is an author, and his new book is Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. So far, we've been talking about his undercover work in the 1970s when he infiltrated two notorious organized crime families. We'll also talk, coming up, Bob, about your work as an NBA referee, and now, of course, your work into helping other people who suffered from post-traumatic stress. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and we'll talk more after a short break.
Christiana Care Health System Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Newsworks.org is your source for smart stories that keep you better informed, better connected, and better prepared. Our network of quality journalists is a step above the rest, and better coverage of important issues means you'll always be a step ahead. Newsworks is something different. News for people who ask more. News for people who care, by people who care. Get involved at Newsworks.org. Newsworks is, simply, news that works. Powered by WHYY and you.
From Public Radio International, I'm Ray Suarez. Whether you're eyeballing foreign markets for signs your 401k might take another hit, or wondering when and how the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan might end, What happens beyond America's shores will affect your life over the next 4 years. On the next America Abroad, Election 2012, Voters and Foreign Policy.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane, and we're talking with author Bob Delaney. His new book is Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. And Bob, you've had a pretty amazing career and have lived through very interesting times. You worked as an undercover agent infiltrating the mob, then went on to become an NBA referee. And now you're helping people who have suffered post-traumatic stress or have post-traumatic stress disorder. And I want to get to that work, but we were just talking about when you're undercover, cover mission ended, resulting in many convictions and arrests of organized crime family members, you had a lot of symptoms. And you said you ran into your old psychology professor from college, and did he know something was wrong with you, and that's why he talked to you?
Well, that investigation had so much notoriety around the country after it came out that it was almost a three-year undercover job, because back then law enforcement wasn't doing those kinds of investigations. It was by bust. And so when I was speaking at the Jersey City Police Department at their training facility, Dr. Campbell happened to be there as well, and he was doing work with them. And so he knew the story because it was one of his former students that happened to be, and I always got along with him, and we started talking more and more, and I think that what he sensed was that I needed to speak about this, and he encouraged me to, and we started some informal therapy is the best way to describe it, and that's when I first learned about post-traumatic stress disorder.
But if somebody had told you back then, oh, Bob, you're in therapy, would you have bristled at the thought?
Probably, yeah. I would not have looking at it as therapy was what was important probably in allowing me to get through this process.
What did your family notice in you, your friends? What were they saying to you?
My friends and family wanted me to be the same person I was when I left. And that is pretty common. I hear that from soldiers, cops, and firefighters when I work with them. And I share my story, is that I had that same feeling. Is they remember me as the guy who was before I went undercover, and they wanted me to be exactly that same person, and they reacted and treated me in the same way as it was 1975 instead of 1978 and those experiences that I had. It chipped away a part of my personality. I was not as quick to laugh. I was not as social, and people were not reacting to that well. It was constantly, what's wrong with you? Why are you acting like this? And the more that came to me, the more I withdrew. And that was where the isolation and avoidance would come.
Do you remember what you wanted to be at that time? Did you want to be the person you were before? Did you want to be Bobby Covert? Who did you want to be?
Yeah, I think that I was searching so strongly. I look back, it was such a confusing time because although I wanted to get away from being Bobby Covert so much, there were so many times that I would fall back into that because that was my normalcy. That was my norm. So I was pushing to go back. And it reminds me of what takes place with our men and women who serve us. They want to come back to Main Street USA, but then they want to fall back to Main Street Baghdad or Main Street Kandahar because that's their norm. That makes sense to them.
When did you start getting better? You continued to work as a state trooper for several years. So when did you start feeling better or experienced relief from those symptoms?
The peer-to-peer therapy with Joe Pistone was very helpful. The speaking with Dr. Campbell was tremendously helpful. But it was also another piece to the puzzle. I knew that I wanted to put myself someplace that gave me an inner peace. It wasn't a conscious effort, but I knew that the game of basketball was very important to me. I played at the high school level. I played in college. There was nothing better to me than a Friday night in a high school gym where kids are playing ball and their families and the school is supporting them. So I started refereeing. I started refereeing more to be in an environment that was protective for me. And it opened the door for another career. Somebody was seeing me work a ball game. They asked if I was interested in working the Jersey Shore Summer Pro League. I did. Daryl Garrettson happened to be in the stands. He's the director of officials for the NBA. He asked if I wanted to go to L.A. and work in the Summer Pro League. I just thought I'd get a free trip to L.A. And shortly after that, I was hired into the Continental Basketball Association, the minor leagues in the NBA back then, and then I got into the NBA. For me, it opened the door to another career. What I say to folks is, when you're going through tough times, find something that gives you your inner peace. For some, it may be quilting. For some, it may be photography. Whatever it is that gives you your inner peace, that's what you should be searching for, because it allows you to be balanced.
We're talking with Bob Delaney. He has a new book called Out of the Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. If you have a question for Bob, give us a call. We're at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. If you have a question about Bob's undercover work or his work in the NBA as a referee or his newer work in the field of PTSD, give us a call. So what was the most fun about your job as an NBA referee?
Being able to be part of competition. We all love to compete. I play golf, and I'll be out on the golf course with my 50 and 60 year old friends, and they've been very successful in life, but over a $2 putt, their hands are shaking before they make that putt. It's the excitement of the competition. I got to be part of one of the all-time great sports in our society for a long period of time. 25 years at the National Basketball Association level, 3 years in the minor leagues, and prior to that at the high school and college level. So to be part of that competition allowed me to have a good feeling, and to be out on the floor with the greatest players in the world, it's exciting.
Do you think on some level you were craving the adrenaline rush that comes with the game? Because that's part of also the whole PTSD issue is the ups and downs of adrenaline.
Yeah, the physiology of post-traumatic stress is very interesting as well. Dr. Guy De Silva, I went through some medical problems not too long ago. Dr. Guy De Silva worked with me, and he explained it real quickly. He said simply, like exposure to the sun can show up as a cancer 30 years later, exposures to long periods of trauma can show up in other areas of your life. So in reality, I had adrenal fatigue. My adrenal gland shut down as a result of the fight flight, which we can go into. But those feelings that you have and those feelings that you go through are very real to you. And that physiology of understanding. And when Guy De Silva gave me that example, it hit home. It gave me a true understanding of there's more going on here than just an emotional and psychological part of it.
And I want to talk about all of those issues in a little bit. As you were in the NBA as a referee, were you still on occasion experiencing real symptoms of post-traumatic stress, or had it subsided?
It subsided somewhat, but I still think that there's parts of it that I still struggle with. I say to folks that it need not be a lifelong sentence, but it is a lifelong journey of healing. And my anger levels were still high for a long period of time afterwards. And even to this day, at times, my reactions are not what should fit what is taking place. So, real simple, spilled milk causes for a higher reaction, not just using it as a metaphor, but that's what happens. You start to look at yourself and saying, why am I reacting that way? And there's bits and pieces of triggers that will cause for me to go back and have that kind of feeling inside of me.
How long did it take for you to have a firm sense of you, this is who I am? How many years later did that return to you, where you felt at home with yourself?
Yeah, it was probably a good 4, 5, 6 years, somewhere in there, where I started to feel as though I was back to Bob Delaney, and then I had to work on Bob Delaney, and then I had to become introspective. I use a formula for development, and it's experiences plus intellectual readiness plus reflection equals development. And that's in every walk of life, if it's leadership development or personal development. So I had to take my experiences, and then I had to study what was going on. I had to have that intellectual readiness, be exposed to, listen to others, read, and then I had to be reflective. And that's not the most easy thing to do, is to be introspective and look at what's going on inside of you. And that's where I think my personal growth came, is I got serious about looking at the person in the mirror and about what I was doing and how I was impacting others.
When did you come to accept, okay, I have something called post-traumatic stress, or I don't know if you ever wanted to call it a disorder, or how you dealt with that part of it?
Yeah, I came to that acceptance probably not too long after Dr. Campbell said that to me. Internally, I wouldn't verbalize it to others and wouldn't tell others that I had that. But I think probably within the 6 months period after he first said it to me, there was an acceptance of knowing that there was something going on inside of me. But it probably took me another 3 to 4 years before I would speak about it. What I say very freely in front of groups today about what I was experiencing took me years to be able to process and understand and then speak about.
And what fueled your desire now to really make this topic your next big mission? Was it the wars? Was it suffering you see among police officers? What brought this?
Yeah, during the entire time that I was in the MBA, I still present at law enforcement academies. And the more that I speak, the more I get people come up to me on breaks and say I'm going through something similar. So I know that this is something that is out there that needs attention. So one opportunity after another, getting in front of groups, I realized that this is an area, and I have an understanding because I went through it, that I want to share this story, and I want to hopefully help others work through it and understand that there is hope, and that's the reason for the title. There is hope with post-traumatic stress. It need not be looked at as if this is going to be a problem you have your entire life. It's a human condition.
Let's take a call. We have Bob joining us from Arcadia University. Hi, Bob. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. I'm driving my car listening to this Mr. Delaney story, and I have to tell you, I began to suffer anxiety just vicariously thinking about the terror you must have gone through. I'm driving my car and I'm having an anxiety attack. So that's one thing. The second thing is I'm wondering that if it ever came across Mr. Delaney's mind that somebody in the FBI could out him. And we know in the Whitey Bulger case, there were FBI agents who were very criminal or unreliable. Did it ever cross his mind that he could be betrayed by his own? And I'll take my call off the air.
So who did you trust? Who did you trust, Bob?
Yeah, Bob, we were very concerned about all aspects of it. Police corruption exists at all levels. So when we were put into the undercover phase, it was a real need-to-know basis. There were tremendous safeguards put into place that way. And we were always concerned about that. We were concerned about every aspect of our security.
So was there anybody you really, really trusted, or was it only you?
The other trooper that was assigned to the investigation and the FBI agents that were right there that we were working with on a daily basis was our trust. That was our support group. And yet we weren't honest with each other about our feelings, because it wasn't until later that he came out and would talk about this. I was in that position where I was the front guy. I was the one that was meeting with the mob guys. I was the one that was the mob associate. So I had more exposure than the others. But that support group was there. And, you know, Pat Kelly was the guy that I was with most of the time. And he really was a mob guy, and he's an informant. So there was only a certain level of trust. And, I didn't trust him wholeheartedly.
I want to just mention something that I've noticed, that on occasion you change the way you speak. And it almost sounds like you're falling back to your undercover days. How did you talk back then, and how hard was it to give that up?
I probably still fall back into it, as you say. But I don't know that I how long it took for me to get out of that. I know it took a long time for me to get rid of the clothes. I would still dress like I was a wise guy. I would come out in 1978. I surfaced, and I had to realize that I'm going to testify as a trooper. I had to change the way I dressed, but I was still wearing like leather jackets and a chain around my neck, and had that whole look of back in the 70s into the 80s. And so it took a period of time for that to take place.
Did you have a significant other during this period, or was just...
I was single at the time, but I did get married after the investigation had completed.
Did trust remain an issue during those years when you really struggled, because it was so hard to trust anybody?
Yeah, I think I still struggle with it to this day. I think that there's My wife says it takes long for me to – I almost don't trust anyone. It takes me a while before I'll hand it over. You will think that I trust you, but internally I don't. I'll give across that image as I trust someone. But internally, it takes a while before I'll get to that point that I'll really open up with people.
Are undercover agents today better prepared for what they are signing up for?
Absolutely.
Yeah, how so? What are they?
Yeah, Homeland Security has a tremendous program. The FBI has a tremendous program, and local state agencies. There's a whole understanding of what the dynamics of working undercover can do, and there are programs in place. And as a result of those of us that went before, and it's like everything else. You don't have to be sick to get better. So we constantly are talking about ways to do things better for the undercover agent. There's tremendous programs put into place for supervisors of undercover agents so that they understand what to look for.
You recently had to testify, or not in the distant past, had to testify once again in the case that you were involved in. In recent years, have you run into anybody? Have you seen any of the people that you helped put away?
Well, on occasion, I've crossed paths with some folks that I put away, and it's almost like it's a business kind of attitude that comes back towards me. But the case that you refer to is Michael Coppola. I was brought in to testify against Michael Coppola in Brooklyn Federal Court about 2 years ago, and he was picked up on charges, and I was brought in to show the ongoing criminality that he was involved in, even from the 70s up until the present time, and he was convicted and given another sentence.
But at some point, you say there was a hit out on your life.
Yeah, when I surfaced from doing the undercover work back in the 70s, I was brought back to division headquarters a few days after the raid that I described earlier, and they played a wiretap, and on there it was talk of a hit on me as well as informant information. And, it doesn't make for a great day. Major Baum, Bill Baum, was tremendous. He walked me through it. They had security teams assigned to be with me, and that added to the tremendous amounts of paranoia that I went through.
Did you ever consider hiding, not living the very out in public life you eventually chose, but did you ever considering just going away?
No, I didn't. When that question is asked, what I share with folks is, in 1978, my personal security level went to orange, and we have all been living that since 2001, since 9/11. If I would have went into hiding, the mob guys would have won. If we would have gone into hiding as a country and not gone on planes and not gone to public places, Bin Laden would have won. So we don't become paralyzed by fear. We move forward, and we go about, and we're more vigilant and aware, but hiding wasn't an option.
So there eventually did the feeling of threat level then subside as
it
you
does,
went
it
on?
Did, subside.
Did it go back to normal?
It did subside, but there's still always an awareness. And there's years and times and distance between that element.
But it never quite goes
never
away.
Never goes away.
We're talking with Bob Delaney. He worked undercover as a police officer for 3 years, then went on to become an NBA referee. And his new book is called Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. And coming up on Radio Times, we'll talk some more about new treatments that are available to people who have PTSD and some of the work you're doing with our military. If you have a question for Bob, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times.
Moorestown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Saturday, November 12th at 10 a.m. Founded in 1785, Moorestown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, multimedia, and all open house dates can be found online at mfsopportunities.org. mfsopportunities.org. Moorestown Friends School.
On the next Fresh Air, physicist Brian Green explains why some astrophysicists think we live in a multitude of parallel universes. One possibility?
It's like a cosmic bubble bath of universes. Our universe is one bubble in this big cosmic bubble bath.
Green's book, The Hidden Reality, is out in paperback, and he's hosting a new PBS Nova series. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Peter Bergen produced Osama bin Laden's first television interview. Now he chronicles his last days in a new film. Also, how is the NBA lockout affecting small businesses around the arenas? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with author Bob Delaney. His new book is called Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. And Bob, we've talked a lot about your life and your own experiences with PTSD. And now I want to talk about some of the new treatments and some of the things that you find are very important in helping people with PTSD. Right now, you're traveling all over the country talking on military posts. What are you hearing there? What's your message to soldiers?
Yeah, I've been doing that for quite some time now. I've been over to Iraq on a few occasions. I've been to Landstuhl. I've been throughout Europe at military bases. As you said, the United States. I was just at the Warrior Transition Battalion in Fort Bliss on Tuesday. What we do is I present. And what I hope to do is tell my story so it's reflective and they can kind of listen and figure out if it works for them. One of the things that I say is, if I had a balloon in front of the room as I'm speaking, how do I let the air out of the balloon? I can let it go and it flies all over the room, it's out of control. Or I can take a pin and I pop the balloon, we get the air out, but we don't have a balloon we can use again. The other way is, if I have patience and I'm willing to listen to some sounds that maybe I don't want to hear, and I turn it upside down, I let a little air at a time, and it comes out that screeching noise that is irritating, eventually we get all the air out of the balloon. And we got a full balloon we can use again one day. I share that with them and say, that's what we need to do with our own personal balloons when we're experiencing trauma. Allow that air to get out of our balloon. And how do we do that? We do it through peer-to-peer therapy. Speaking to someone who has gone through a similar circumstance. So after the horrific shootings at Fort Hood, which tomorrow is the anniversary, a two-year anniversary, General Bob Cohen brought me in, and I spent 3 days there speaking with soldiers and civilians and cops that were part of that. And what I asked them to do is not be judgmental about their trauma, because there's a part of that that goes on within inside of us, is that, oh, Mike went through something more difficult than me, so I minimize my trauma or my experience in that traumatic event. So while the folks that were at the epicenter of that shooting, in that room when the shooting took place, are at that spot where it's taking place, there are others that are going through a level of trauma that are maybe 100 yards away, 200 yards away, 300 yards away. So like an earthquake has an epicenter, there's aftershocks that go out from the epicenter for a day, a week, a month later. The same thing happens with the epicenter of a trauma. Others are feeling it. And what I share with them is, you need to tell your story. Don't be judgmental about your story. It's important for you to get that personal ear out of the balloon because, as I said earlier, those who wear uniforms are at a higher risk group. This is a human condition that we're all susceptible to. The folks that I happen to work with are those who serve us. They have a tendency to push one trauma on top of another and say, I can handle it. When in reality, we're all human beings. We need to talk about this. We need to get it out. That's what I hope to encourage. Peer-to-peer therapy, I believe, is the first line of defense in keeping post-traumatic stress at post-traumatic stress and not allowing it to become the disorder.
Do you have an instant rapport with people, especially in uniform, because of who you are and you served, you weren't a soldier, but there's something about you, you're very athletic, you're a guy, you're, you know, so I could see that soldiers would relate to you and who you are.
I think that the message and the fact of what I've done in the past, I know that that undercover story is intriguing, it's a Soprano-esque type story, so that helps. As well as I'm honest about what I went through and those feelings, and that breaks down barriers. And then the MBA side, I've got a couple stories and a life that people open up to and listen to, and that allows me then to give this other information. And I think it does create a rapport, because what I share with them is, you know, cops need to talk to cops, firefighters to firefighters, soldiers to soldiers, combat spouses to combat spouses, and combat moms and dads to combat moms and dads, because they're going through something that is similar. But now I've tweaked it, and I've said that cops need to talk with firefighters and soldiers need to talk with cops and fire, because we come to an understanding that while wearing those uniforms, we're all going through similar kinds of feelings in dealing with the traumas that we do experience.
And do you see more of that peer-to-peer type counseling happening in the military, within police forces?
We're encouraging it, and it's from the top. I've had meetings at the Pentagon with the top military of all the branches, and it's being encouraged tremendously. You know, while psychiatrists and psychologists are needed, that's probably not the first line of defense, because what happens is right away there's a pullback because of the stigma. I'm going to see a psychiatrist, so it's pulled back. While those clinicians are needed in this, it's not the first step, in my belief. We need to go a little bit slower than quicker and rework some of our ways of going about therapy.
We have a call from Richard in South Philadelphia. He has a question for you. Hi, Richard. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, I'm a big fan of Donnie Brasco movie, and I was just wondering how real that was. Not so much in terms of the mob stuff, which I guess I'd like to know also, but the emotions that he went through and kind of traumas that he was showing and his family problems, etc. How close to reality do you think that was for him, and did it bounce off you at all in that way? I'll just say one thing. I used to drive a taxi cab in New York City, and the Taxi Driver movie was nothing like I ever experienced. That was sort of so embellished in terms of the taxi part of it. So I just was wondering how Donnie Brasco rates.
Yeah, I thought that when I walked into that theater, I happened to have a game in Sacramento, and I walked into the theater and sat and watched that movie myself, and it was amazing to me how Johnny Depp sounded exactly like Joe Pistone, and he had every one of his idiosyncrasies down. I thought that the movie had a good, strong understanding of what the emotions are for an undercover agent. I thought it was portrayed well, and I'll also add on that it's Hollywood. Keep that in mind. So there's always going to be some Hollywood in it. I thought that Departed did a great job of showing that as well, the emotions of what that undercover agent was going through. Yet, you know, having him go to the same psychiatrist and as the other cop, well, that starts to become Hollywood. But those kinds of stories give a look into what is going on in the soul of an undercover agent.
Thank you so much for that call, Richard. Now, in your new book, you talk a lot about the people you meet when you go out and speak about PTSD, and you have some truly heartbreaking stories. I'm thinking of the Gallagher family, for example.
Right. Yeah. Jim Gallagher was a Marine who came home after serving in Iraq and went through some tough times and committed suicide. Mary Gallagher, his wife, his children were the ones that found him. He hung himself in a garage at Camp Pendleton in California. It is an emotional story. Interviewing them was extremely emotional. But what their messages and how strong they are to tell their story, to help others understand what suicide does to a family and how it impacts and has a ripple effect. This thing called post-traumatic stress, I believe we're in an epidemic. I think that we're only in the infant stages of truly understanding it. It is a human condition. I documented it back to Sophocles, wrote plays about it, talking about the warrior coming home from battle and not knowing how to act in his own home. We talked about it, called it shell shock during World War I, battle fatigue in World War II. Vietnam, we started to have a better understanding, yet we didn't serve the men and women who served us well out of that war. Today, we need to look at these case studies and have a better understanding and find ways that we can give them alternatives to therapy so that stigma does not exist.
Now, your book, the subtitle is A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. So what are some things that give you hope that people can live with this and can cope and can get better.
Well, I'm a living example. You can get better, and you can work through it, and it's a process. What I'm excited about is the 21st century therapies that are being embraced, like Ride to Recovery, a bicycle ride that goes throughout for long periods of time. So I participate. My wife and I participated in the 9/11 Ride to Recovery Challenge. They're called challenges. They're not races to recovery. They're rides to recovery. It was 350 people, bicycle ride from Ground Zero to Shanksville, to the Pentagon. We went 580 miles over 8 days, went through six states, and 250 of the folks on that ride were wounded warriors. The other 100 were made up of cops and firefighters and victims of family members from the 9/11 attacks. What took place on that ride was peer-to-peer therapy. You had people who went through similar circumstances. It was an honoring of those who were victims that day. It was a remembering, and it was also an honoring of those who have served as a result of those attacks. And to see two soldiers, two vets that have both lost their legs, being able to empathize with each other and help each other understand how they're progressing and what they're going through and what they're feeling, that's true to peer-to-peer therapy. So we put them in an active environment. You have to train for it, so it's ongoing training. It creates a social setting, and it allows for that competition. We spoke about the competition that I was a part of through basketball that helped me as therapy. That's the same thing that's going on to Ride to Recovery. There's things called healing waters where they take veterans with visible and invisible wounds and go out and fish for periods of time and stay out around the campfire. Well, around the campfire that night, that's peer-to-peer therapy. There are hunting programs. John Phelps runs programs out in Wyoming. His son, Champs Phelps, was the subject of a movie called Taking Chance, where Kevin Bacon played the soldier in an HBO movie. This was a Marine who was brought back, and his father runs programs to help soldiers work through post-traumatic stress.
Is it important, you think, for this for especially the groups in uniform, to think outside of the box and to find ways to maybe not call it talk therapy or anything that could make them just say, oh, I don't want to do that?
I agree with you 1,000%. Traditional therapy is not working because they're backing up. They're not walking towards traditional therapy. We've got to figure out ways to be able to put them in an environment that allows peer-to-peer therapy, allows that air to get out of their personal balloons. But it can't be assigned to be at 3 o'clock at the psychiatrist's office. It's not working.
Now, you describe a meeting with a very non-traditional doctor in your book, Dr. Gordon, who greeted you barefoot, for starters, which surprised you, I take it. So what's his approach and what does he do?
Yeah, Jim Gordon is an amazing guy. He's in Haiti right now. Jim, as you described, the first time I met him, Jim walks into the office. He's got a pair of slacks and a golf shirt on and no shoes and no socks. And we sat down and had a cup of tea. And we started talking about post-traumatic stress. Jim uses expressive art, expressive dance, as way of releasing. Because sometimes people are having a difficult time verbalizing what they're feeling. And they may be thinking it, but they don't know how to get it out. Well, rather than putting them in a spot to have to say it, Jim has them act out or just release themselves and gives them a feeling of freedom and being understanding and mindful of what's going on inside of them. And there's an expressions that come out. And then he can help interpret what's going on in a very slow process rather than thinking we're going to solve this thing in two sessions kind of thing. And there's actually a farm called Quantum Leap Farm that they have a big white horse that they allow the vets to paint on. So this horse is the most docile horse. He just stands there, and I guess it feels like petting to him, but they have a brush and they paint on him. That's their expression that's coming out. And it's amazing what you can see is being said through those kinds of art and dance and how people are able to release some of those things that are internal.
But how does the idea of expressive dance go over with a group
of veterans? Yeah. That's not work. I mean, you know, like when Jim worked with firefighters after 9/11, you know, they all sat back in their seats, they folded their arms, and they gave him this look like, this is not happening, pal. I mean, we're not going to be doing this. And he wins them over. And then what happens there is then he gets some disciples who then go out in the fire department or the police department or with the military and start saying, you know, this thing works. What this guy's talking about is it works. And that's how we start making this kind of movement.
Now, Bob, you just retired from the NBA.
Yes.
Is this your next act, this work? Do you see that as your next big career chapter?
Yeah, physically I could have continued in the NBA for another year or two, I think, or maybe longer. I was having to turn down so many opportunities to be with those who serve us that, you know, it's been said that there's two great days in your life, the day you're born and the day you figure out why you were born. So this is the next chapter for me. I'm dedicating to me, this is a mission of going to those who serve us and asking them to become a little bit selfish, you know, because they're the givers in the game of life, and I'm going to ask them to take care of themselves a little bit. I just want to share with you, Tim Karcher is a lieutenant colonel who lost both legs in Iraq. I was with him at the Center for Intrepid down in San Antonio as he was going through therapy. And he shared this with me. He said, Bobby, you know, post-traumatic stress is like dieting. Some of us need to lose 5 to 10 pounds. Some of us 10 to 20. Some of us are morbidly obese. And I thought, Tim, what a great way to describe something that in a way that we could put a quantitative measure that isn't really something that we measure. And I said, but I know I've carried 5 to 10 or 15, 20 pounds around at times that I wish I could lose, but I still had a happy and productive life. And I learned to manage that, and I learned to work, and I kept working on trying to. So it's not about losing all of your post-traumatic stress. It's about learning how to manage it and work with it. And the other thing that I would say to folks is that when someone is going through post-traumatic stress, their family and friends are going through active traumatic stress, and they're reacting to that. So giving an education and awareness program to those in the military, cops, firefighters, to their family and friends, so that they understand what potentially those loved ones who are in the services may be going through is an important thing. We've done it with HIV/AIDS. We've done it with drugs and alcohol and tobacco. I believe we need a national education and awareness program for post-traumatic stress.
And we just have a few seconds left, but are you hopeful that we're having a more open discussion? And is there research coming out that inspires you and makes you hopeful?
Yeah, I believe we are. I think conversations like we're having, the more that we can put this out in the open, the better.
Our guest on Radio Times has been Bob Delaney. His new book is Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. Bob, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us
today. It's a pleasure.
Today.
Stay safe.
Thank you. Again, that book is Surviving the Shadows, A Journey of Hope into Post-Traumatic Stress. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowen.